This conference is being recorded.
Okay, did anyone join us since we started to turn the thing on record?
Betsy McGovern?
Hey, Betsy.
Hey there, how's it going?
Good, good. We just turned the recorder on so that we can podcast these at our toolbox. We're putting these up on the, I don't know if any of you have gotten to the toolbox, brownfieldstoolbox.org. But we've got a new and improved website, and it's going to, we try to get as much of the materials as we can, reference materials, in one place. So we're putting it up on a toolbox, and under there you'll see PLC. Under the PLC, we're putting podcasts of all the sessions, and we're going to be adding other things as we get it, and as people contribute things, we'll be also adding those. So as this podcast starts, I probably just have to say the RFP for the new Brownfields job training session was released today, and I think I emailed everyone a copy of it, the official RFP, and it'll be due December 1st. When an RFP comes out, federal employees are not allowed to speak to individuals about their grant. So I think it's appropriate for us to give a disclaimer, since we're a grantee of EPA, that we can't talk about specific grants. We can hold public meetings, which this is, and talk in general about the grant, and we could talk about what we're going to talk about is what makes a good job training program. It's interesting that when you look at the RFP, they basically use the same tools as we have in evaluating what is a good RFP. So we have about eight areas that are very important to us to make a sustainable job training program. It just so happens that they're very similar to those. Who just joined us?
Hello, I'm sorry, I'm late.
Well, okay, demerits.
Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
We've got Catherine and Betsy and Guy and Lynn and George on the line.
And hey, great.
I'm breaking the rules. I told them we are recording, and I did also give them a disclaimer that we can't talk about individual grant proposals. We can talk about things in general, and we can also talk about what makes a good job development program and what people should be doing as they develop and plan a program. And there is a coincidental thing that this is exactly what they're evaluating on, but we started doing this quite a long time ago, and I think as they've evolved their evaluation criteria, they've kind of looked at some of the materials that we've developed and worked it into their RFAs. So,
well, if I could just point out one more resource. On the new Brownfields Toolbox, under the PLC corner, there is a public forum where I've posted a discussion topic for these guidelines. The people could go in and use each other as a resource, ask questions. It's a threaded discussion. So if you go in there and you post a question, someone else might be able to give you an answer, and then other people can go there and read what's going on, and you guys can just all help each other that way. Grantees are a huge resource for other potential grantees, so I just want to point that out as another resource, and I'll put something out on the listserv about that. I just did that this morning.
An interesting general observation of the last couple of days. I don't know if everyone listened to the EPA podcast that they had of this. One interesting observation, there were about 67 people on the conference call. That's down from over 100 on the stimulus conference call. Just an interesting observation that it seems like there'll be a lot less competition. And this is my own personal opinion. It seems like there's going to be less in terms of applicants at this point. The other observation I made that after we finished that conference call is there are a whole lot of hoops that one has to jump through, which will again dramatically, I think, decrease the competition for these RFAs. And maybe it was intentional. I think that one thing that I observed, I don't know if you all observed that, but anyone who could answer all those questions well is got a slam dunk as far as a successful program. I think they have studied this well enough, and those people are so well experienced in job training, they've been with it for 10 years, that they know everything it takes to work and not work. And I can't think of, can Glo or George or Lynn or anyone think of something that they did not cover, that that when we think about a successful job program, they have nailed it in terms of if you could answer all those questions, you've got it locked. You've got a successful program. Would you all pretty much agree with that, or any exceptions?
Yeah, that's pretty comprehensive. I think you're right on with that.
Very, very comprehensive. Something that was, and some of y'all might have missed the last conference call, one of the confusing things was that answering every question is so important. And I think Paula was asked the question, are you going to actually put the numbers next to your responses? And she said, we're really going to consider putting numbers next to each response because this thing is so involved. But one of the things I thought we might talk about today is for any good job training program, the things that I observe that one has to do before they even start a job training program. And these are things that take some time and can't be done at the last minute. We're not talking about anything to do with the grant today, but we're talking about in a good job development program. And one of the things that I think is important is this the public meeting. It's very important to have a public forum before you even start your job training program. And this is something that if you wait till the last minute and say you're just going to start a job training program, it doesn't work. Interesting enough, I was listening to the conference call for the assessment. There's three major grant proposals that are due December 1st that we need to be aware of. One is the assessment, brownfield assessment pilots, the revolving loan fund pilots, and the cleanup pilots. And the ones I think that are most important to the job development training programs are the assessment pilots and the cleanup pilots, because these are both going to require jobs. And the thing that I observed in listening to the requirement, you submit a grant, between now and December 1st, cleanup grants and assessment grants and revolving loan funds have to develop proposals and have to develop their partnerships just as you would have to do if you were submitting to EPA. Well, if I was developing a job training program, I would definitely partner, and it's to their benefit, and it would be to anyone who has a job development training program benefit to partner with the applicants for the new RLF and ARC and the cleanup grants, the three grants. And between now and then, all of these communities are going to be submitting a large amount of grant. There's going to be quite a bit of money going to these grants. And they range from $400,000 or $500,000 to over $1 million per grant. And particularly those cleanup grants, to the extent that you are partnering before anything is organized, any job training program is organized, you're going to be well ahead of the game. Not talking about the job training grant, but talking about the RLF grants, those kind of grants, they're expecting them to hold public hearings, and they're supposed to announce their programs and get feedback from the public. If I were starting a program today, I would start right now. There's certain things that I would want to do, and one is establishing these partnerships with the potential revolving loan fund assessment pilot and cleanup pilots right now, and get your name on their list and their name on your list. And also, I would do my initial marketing in terms of holding a public hearing, putting an ad in the newspaper that I was forming a job development program. And I would do that very early, because if you wait till next month, it could be too late. You'll be trying to recreate things at the last minute. So now you all up in New Jersey, you've kind of gone through this, haven't you, already? Held your public hearings and interacted with the community.
Lots of action, interaction with the community. We've had some public meetings where we partnered with a local municipality. Mm-hmm. And I got onto their agenda just to go in and explain what we would be doing over the next few months. Mm-hmm. Although
it's
we haven't had a public hearing in some time.
Yeah, it's really important. And one of the things, as I was listening to the RFA for cleanup and assessment pilots, this isn't our pilot, but this isn't the job training, this is other pilots, they were saying you really need to hold these public hearings, and if you held one a long time ago, you need to really have one fairly current that announces.
Sorry, in the past, depending on the project, Mike, we've gone out and the local elected officials did a public resolution supporting our actions.
Fantastic. That's
it's
so important.
Dividends for us, yes.
That is so important in developing a job development program. It's one of the initial steps. You know, we talk about initial steps of developing partners, but this is even before you start developing your partners, because when you have a public meeting and a public announcement, your partners may come to you and that you don't know about. So, and there's a lot of different strategies for holding a public meeting. One is just going to City Hall and talking about your intents to start a job development program. Another one is to put an ad in the paper. And Paula apologized she wouldn't be able to attend today, but they're very effective at putting ads in newspapers. They would put an announcement, sometimes a public service announcement on the radio, that they document, or sometimes they put a public service announcement in a paper or hold a meeting at a community college that they're planning on starting a job development training program in the community, and they're looking for support and partners. And this is, people don't realize that you need to do this before you start your program, so that often it's never done, and it's critical that you you involve the community. Involving community in developing your job development program is just so important that through the whole success of the program. I know you all have been extremely successful that way, George and Lynn, in with the New Jersey Youth Corps and getting the word out. And,
I had a question, Mike, and maybe you know this. On average, how long do you think people are spending conducting labor market analysis for their training programs?
Not enough, and
no.
this is another major downfall of job development programs. I think this is a big problem with green jobs. There is not enough. I feel strongly enough that if you start talking about the order of importance in developing a job development program, the community involvement is probably number one, right there with partners and labor market assessment. After you get through those, the rest kind of falls into place. But your partners and your labor market assessment and your community involvement are total keys to this thing working. And people, just like the community involvement, they take short shrift of the labor market assessments. And I think that's a big mistake, because when your labor market assessment is going to determine what your curriculum is going to be, and it'll also help you develop your advisory committees, and it'll help you also bring in partners and subcontractors. So it is critical. What I would also suggest, when you're doing your labor market assessment, I would go to the state and look at their Department of Commerce resources and the Department of Labor resources. For example, in North Carolina, they publish every year a North Carolina Career Outlook Handbook, and they go into incredible detail with SOC codes, minimum education requirements, growth outlooks, current workers, salaries, salary schedules. I mean, they do, and they post this online. And this is done by the North Carolina Employment Security Commission. So you might, as part of your assessment, look at your existing resources that are as a starting point, because there may be something that you could use as a base, and more than likely it won't be detailed enough for brownfield job development, but it will give you a broad brushed look at the employment situation and the career outlook in your state. And I would go to the Employment Security Commission, I would go to the Department of Commerce, ideally in the state, but even in your mayor's office, depending on the size of your city, you might have a, in your mayor's office, you might have a commissioner of economic development who's looked into a lot of these things. But that labor market assessment is key, and that's something that, again, without a good one, you're cooked, and because it'll direct the flow of your curriculum, whether you want to be doing lead paint or whether you want to be doing R&P, or if you want to be working on confined space or perhaps even underground storage tanks. Interestingly enough, as I had said before, in terms of contacting the people developing grants for assessment and cleanup grants, there is a major effort in fiscal 10, 2010, for underground storage tanks. And if, for example, they submit a grant that's due December 1st for doing underground storage tanks, by the time you get your award, if you were to start a program today, you would be graduating students about when they start looking for people to work on these underground storage tanks. So here's a perfect example of why partnering with the assessment and cleanup people before you start your program is so important. They'll be ramping up next summer, and you'll probably, if you're starting a program, be ramping up, you know, before that, but not much before that. Your graduates will be coming out about the time they're going to need people. So both on the cleanup grants and the cleanup grants, the underground storage tanks, and the assessment pilot. So, but that's part of the assessment also. I would, you know, I think it's very important to, it's critically important to see what brownfields are currently active in your community. That's an absolute must in starting a program. Which ones are being proposed? What will be online when you start creating graduates? That's really key. Some of these are, you know, we found that some of these grantees are concentrating on meth labs or petroleum, abandoned gas stations, as I just mentioned, or it might just be the traditional hazardous material sites. It might be dry cleaners, for example, or something else. So, I think all of you that have been in the PLC, we spent a little bit of time talking about what JFI was doing on these labor market assessments, and JFY had taken this novel approach of identifying first the key industries that would be hiring your people, and then not using surveys but doing interviews and going out to these key industries and interviewing the people one-on-one to get more of a verbal type of assessment and the types of jobs and type of curriculum that you may want to develop in your program. it's a novel approach, and it's a really good approach because your data is a lot more valid. And actually, if you can call one-on-one, you might even get a better response than you would in a mail. What have you all used traditionally in your labor market assessment up in New Jersey?
We've gone out and identified the industries, first of all, and then we're a strong believer in making the one-on-one telephone calls.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the way to go.
Yeah, I mean,
not only
this is a cold call, but you know, you can be explaining who we are and what we're going to be doing, and have environmental techs ready in 120 days or 90 days or whatever it is, and some are very receptive, and those will send out a formal package of information on our program, and then we will follow up with the personal visit.
Well, the other thing about that is you're also getting really good information in terms of potential partners,
yes,
potential contributors, even potential subcontractors that you may want to use in your training.
No, that's very true, Mike. And some by making the one-on-one calls, though that may appear at first to look like a good candidate, after talking to them, you find out that it's an engineering outfit or it's an aerial survey or something within the brownfields, but something that really, they don't look for environmental techs. Those you can cross off the list. And some of the companies are really just small family-operated companies. And then those we often off the list.
Mm-hmm.
But believe me, if you sit down and make those one-on-one calls, you will find wonderful candidates to hire your environmental techs.
You know, the nice thing about small companies is it's an easier hire. You know what I'm talking about? You don't have to go through an HR department.
No, you're right. No, that's true, Mike. What I meant by small, I remember making several calls where it was like a father and son operation. And there was one that was a father-daughter operation, just two or three people.
Right.
But you're absolutely right about some of the smaller outfits. A person can go in for an interview today and start tomorrow.
That's right. That's right. And the people that are interviewing them are the top people, and they're decision makers. So you're not going through 10 interview processes, and if they feel they like you and they know that you know what you're talking about, you can move up very fast. They're great jobs. But the interesting thing about that, George, is that those people would probably have never responded to a survey.
No, I don't believe they would have, Mike. No.
Yeah. And the other thing is that you need in a really good program to make it very good is you've got to link your core curriculum to the labor market assessment or demonstrate that you have. And the question is how do you link your labor market assessment to your core curriculum? Well, you need to demonstrate that you did this interview process, you did this survey, you went to the Employment Security Commission to get the broad overview, and this is what you're finding from your findings. And this is your core curriculum based on this summation of data that you've collected in your labor market assessment. So that's how you flow it through. Anyone who just plunks down the standard courses, it just doesn't work.
And because we did go out to the employers, and we did form an advisory committee very early on with employers on it, we asked them, what do you look for in an entry-level employee? So besides the 40-hour and some other certifications, some wanted landscaping. Everybody wanted a good knowledge of preventative maintenance checks and services. And that's just checking basic fuel levels and oil levels and tire pressures, just to keep the equipment up and running every day. Mm-hmm. Some wanted welding skills. We incorporated that. And a few other things that I think EPA wondered why we were doing this, but it was because this is what the employers wanted to see.
That's right. And those will be the people that will hire your students. And it's just so much better and it's people, it's not innovative, it's just the right way to do it, but so
great
many people, they don't think about this. And the last thing I wanted to cover today, in terms of this very early stages of developing a job development program that we never think about, and these are kind of the things we're covering today, is this whole issue of sub-grantees and subcontractors. And it's an interesting thing that I observe. Now, if you're starting a general program and you're not getting federal funds or you don't care about federal funds, it doesn't really matter. You just go out and hire whoever you want. If you are applying for federal funds, you're a little bit in a catch-22. When you write a proposal of some sort, you have to make sure that you have to provide the experience and knowledge and capabilities of your subgrantees and your subcontractors. But here's the catch-22, is that you cannot give that experience or it will not be looked upon unless those people have gone through the proper vetting process, which means you have to go out, if they're a contractor, any for-profit contractor or consultant, you have to go out for a bid. If they're a subgrantee, they have to meet all the requirements posed by the subgrantee. So you see where I'm going as a chicken and egg thing. You have to actually have your subs and your subcontractors lined up before you write your grant proposal if you really want to show your best, but at the same time, you've got to go out for competitive bid on many of these things. So what you almost have to do, and this is an interesting thing in starting a program and the pre-planning of that, is you have to line up your subs without any money. I mean, in other words, you have to competitively bid or get some sort of documentation that they're the ones you want to use prior to even hiring them. And that's an early stage thing that, again, is a major trap that you could fall into because, for example, if you write a grant proposal and you say you're going to have these types of subcontractors and these subgrantees on board, well, if they haven't been vetted properly, none of that counts. They don't qualify because you did not go out on a competitive process or you didn't vet them as a subgrantee properly. So this is kind of a bear trap that anyone could get into in starting a program if they decide to go after federal funds of some sort. Of course, if you're not going after federal funds, it doesn't really matter. But it's something that you have to look back at the early stages, the very beginning of your along with your developing your partners and your labor market assessment and your public hearings, lining up your subgrantees and subcontractors under, and if they're subcontractors, have to be competitively bid. Well, it's pretty hard to bid it out exactly, but you can get rates, labor rates, and have them submit some sort of proposal and then choose based on going to three sources who you want to use. And then you could include their capabilities and experience and knowledge, but you also have demonstrated that you went out on a competitive process. As they talked about in the annual grantee meeting, if you had done that in a previous life, and if you had done it under, if you were a community college or someone and you had done that previously and established it, that's okay. But if you're starting a brand new program and you're going to go after any kind of funds, I don't care what kind it is, if you want to have a really good practice, you need to vet your subgrantees and your subcontractors way before you even write the proposal. And that's just a bear trap that people can fall into.
I have a question about that. We have a local youth corps, conservation corps. It's one of a handful of California conservation corps in the state. And they're kind of we've had sole source language with them before just because it's a job training program and there's been different guidance released from the Department of Transportation and other folks, basically saying that since they're the only provider of this type of program in our area, that we can do a direct contract with them instead of going out to bid. Have you heard anything about that, or do you?
Well,
I mean,
my basic understanding, there is a, when in reading all those things, it says if there is no other, you know, but they strongly recommend you go out by email or something and establishing documentation that, because someone could come along and say, no, we could do that. We'll do that. Some private firm or someone else. You really, to be on the safe side, you really need to go out and do some sort of competitive analysis or bid. If it's even going to a consulting firm and saying, do you provide these services, or what is your rate? Now, if they're a subgrantee, there's a difference. If they're a subcontractor or a subgrantee, that bidding process does not take place. And George,
okay.
Lynn and Flo could correct me on this, but as we were talking to the EPA legal counsel, if you make them a partner as a subgrantee, they are subject to all of the requirements that you are as a grantee. In other words,
that's true.
If you get audited, they get audited. They're a subgrantee. They have to know indirect costs. They can't charge indirect costs. They can't. Everything that you're subject to, they are subject to.
Okay.
They have to go out on competitive bid if they contract out. So that's the catch-22 on the subgrantee. If they're a subcontractor, you really have to go out and do a competitive bid. And
okay.
And that's really important in the grant proposal writing, because if you give them all of their, you give all their qualifications, and they want you to document that you went out on competitive bid, they'll disallow all of that.
Okay. See, I think we're going to go ahead and just structure it so they're a subgrantee, because we're the city, we're the EPA Brownfields grant recipient of assessment and cleanup funds, so we're sponsoring the application, but they're the ones who are going to actually run the program, do all the job training, do everything associated with the grant, so it makes sense for them to be subgrantees, and then they may turn around at some point and subcontract, you know, certain certifications or different things like that.
They would then be responsible for getting competitive
bids.
Because now, George and Lynn and Glo, would you concur with what I just said?
Yeah,
I would. Yeah.
Yeah. For some reason, though, we don't have to compete if we're funding a public entity. Only
okay.
If we're funding a non-public entity, and we can do a sole source vendor. They call it a sole source. But the justification has to be very strong. And you're right, you have to have additional supporting documentation that no one else can do this service.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it sounds like what you're saying is that subgrantee route is really a nice thing for them to do, and
yes.
Working with Conservation Corps like yourself.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
And you need to keep in close touch with Lynn and George, because they're really doing a great job up there in the Conservation Corps. A little slightly different organization, though, isn't it?
Yes, we're more service than conservation, yes.
Right, right.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, listen, we've gone over our time this week, but we're going to meet again in 2 weeks, and we'll be sending some stuff out, notes, and try to send everyone reference materials. And I'm sure we're going to be putting more things up on the website. So if you get a chance, just check out the website. Glo, do you want to put in a plug for our website?
Well, it just went live a couple of weeks ago, and in fact yesterday I sent two messages out on both of the listservs, the grantee listserv and the outreach listserv, and sent you the link for it, asked you to go out and look around, and today, in fact, I'm getting ready to send out another one. This website is going to be a work in progress. It is always going to be continuously updated. In fact, today I put up an announcement on the job training RFP that includes Joe's presentation that he gave at the Clue-In session on Monday, the 28th. So there's a link to that. I put a thread up to have a threaded discussion on different issues related to developing your proposals under the PLC corner. And I'm putting this all in an email that I'm going to send out again on both listservs and give you links to these different areas just until you guys get used to going out there and checking out the new things that are going to be going up there continuously.
Great. Okay. Well, we'll talk to you all in a couple of weeks then.
Great.
So, have a great couple of weeks here.
Thank you.
Talk to you all soon.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.